The Bible study this week will focus on the book of Revelation, and I welcome you here and are happy to have you. I must tell you that this room is a terrible room to see and hear in, primarily because of the hood. And the worst place is right through the center there, so we make do as best we can with this. Some of you who were here last week will forgive me if I use the same story I began with last week, but since most of you are new, it'll be new to you. But it's quite sincerely, when I sat here last week and saw the people up in the balcony, I couldn't help but think of the story of Paul's sermon in Acts 20, if you remember it. Paul is in this town and must leave the next morning, so he has a lot to say. So he's preaching in the evening, and he goes on and on and on past midnight, and there are people filling the house, and there's some poor guy sitting up in a window on the third floor. And after Paul had finished preaching beyond 12 o'clock or something, this poor chap got sleepy, went to sleep, fell off, and fell to the floor, and was killed dead. Naturally, Paul raised him from the dead, but I want to warn those of you in the balcony to sit back away from the railing. We can't guarantee the resurrection in this case. The other thing I should explain to you is that they tape these sessions. That shouldn't intimidate you if you want to say something, though. And so I will each day bang on this thing to give them the signal to begin. You might know that's what I haven't cracked up or something when I begin playing the drum up here. So let me get the tape rolling, and then we'll begin. This is Bob Kaiser, and the course is entitled Reading the Mysteries, the Book of Revelation for Today. The first session, Beginning the Ending, an Introduction to Revelation. There, we got the tape going now. I want to play word association with you for just a few moments this morning. That's not too hard. That you don't have to think, really, to play word association, do you? But what is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear the book of Revelation, when you hear that referred to? Revelation. What's the first thing that comes into your mind? Pardon?
Prophecy,
okay. Yeah, let's get some of these down. Okay, what else?
Doom,
okay. Fire drills and doom, yes.
Beast,
okay.
Oh, beast.
Beast with a B.
Beast, all right.
Revealing.
Creative spelling there. Show off. Breast. Don't you know what a breast is? Obscure? Did somebody
yes,
say?
Yes, it is.
Now be careful the words you use, make sure I can spell them. What? So I heard another one.
Apocalypse.
Yeah, I heard something right after obscure.
Apocalypse, he said.
Okay.
I said confusing.
Confusing. Okay.
Armageddon.
Uh-oh. Now I am stuck. Spell it for me.
How many M's?
G-E-D-D-O-N.
There you go.
That's pretty close. That's good enough for 9 o'clock in the morning. Anything else?
Mysterious.
Good.
Millennium.
Okay.
A few simple devotional verses.
Few simple devotional verses. Okay. I'll put devotional down, all right?
Yeah.
Well, all right. I see this group's wide awake this morning and moving.
Persecutions.
Persecutions. All right. One more. And now, at this point, I got to quit because I know my spelling is going to become even worse. Okay. Those are all very good. Very honest. The staff meeting this morning, staff Bible study, they first told me what they thought they wanted me to hear, and then they began to get into some of these that were a little more immediate off the top of the mind. I've been wondering what it is that John of Patmos would say if we ask him that question. What is it, John, that you want to come to the minds of people when they hear of your book? And I think that he would answer that question with one word, and that word would be hope. Hope. If Revelation is designed to do anything at all, it seems to me it's designed to speak a word of hope in a situation of hopelessness. If you ever, as I do, get the feeling some days that everything, that all hope is gone. You know, both, you begin to feel that way both because of yourself and because of the world situation, and you just sort of want to despair. And you begin to wonder, what is God doing in this world, and what can He do now? And you sort of feel hopeless. And I think most of us have some of those times in our lives if we're honest with ourselves. If we've had that experience of hopelessness, then I think we know a little bit of what was in the hearts and minds of the first readers and hearers of the book of Revelation. An utter hopelessness. And of course, compared to our situation, their situation was so hopeless, it's hardly comparable. But that hopelessness is what John was trying to speak to in his book of Revelation. And what we're going to try to do this week is to look at the book, ask what it meant, what John intended to say to his first hearers and readers, and then to ask, of course, what does that mean for us? We have only 5 days, and you know the book of Revelation well enough to know that we're not going to get very deep. We're going to skim across the surface, but we'll try to do the best we can in terms of communicating with the meaning of it to you and with you. Before we begin, I want to do a couple of preliminary things. One is to hand out to you an outline of the book of Revelation, which is one that I have found useful. And I'll just start them here. And would somebody back there see that a handful of them get upstairs? That's the first thing I'd like you to do, is to have this outline. And the second thing I want to say is that I hope during this next week you'll have a chance to read the book of Revelation. Beginning tomorrow, we're going to kind of prod through it chapter by chapter, you know, just hitting some of the highlights in the chapters. But it will be very helpful to you, I think, if you will have read it sometime during this week. I do not recommend it for nighttime reading, bedtime reading, because of the nightmares that usually come as a consequence of it. But I hope you will find a few minutes to read it during this week. And then I want to suggest to you three books, which, oops, has to be plugged in. Three books which I recommend to you as useful in understanding the book of Revelation. The first is written by Richard Jeske, Revelation for Today, Images of Hope, Fortress. It's brand new this spring, 1983. Professor Jeske teaches at the Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia, and this book is written out of the series that he did. I'm sorry, you see what I mean now by that thing. This book is written on the basis of a series on Revelation that he did for The Lutheran. If some of you are LCA and you get that journal, and he's brought them together now into a book. It includes the text of Revelation, so that he gives you the text and then he gives you a page or so of comment, a couple of pages of comment on it. Another book that's very good, I think, is Fiorenza's Invitation to the Book of Revelation, Doubleday, 1981. That also is a little commentary. It has the passages from Revelation in the New Jerusalem Bible translation, and then her comments upon them. She is a specialist in Revelation, and this is her effort to try to translate her special expertise into language that lay people and ordinary people who don't know much about Revelation can understand. The third book I would recommend is the one that has influenced me so heavily, and if you have read it, or if you do read it, you'll see how wedded I am and influenced by George Caird's commentary on the Revelation of St. John the Divine, Harper and Row. It's a 1966 book. Now, something happened. There was a confusion, a mistake, or something in my book orders. So consequently, I'm not sure that we'll have this in time to use it. But she has ordered it, I think, and suggested to me that it ought to be in by early this week, middle of this week or something, Jeske's book. So I'll keep you informed. There are a few copies of Fiorenza's book. There are none of Caird's in the bookstore. Okay, those are some of the things that I recommend. Now, in this first session, I want only to introduce the Book of Revelation to you and the kind of literature it is. Let me get all my misspellings up here. I'm going to be paranoid about putting anything up here now after that, after my spelling difficulties. If you've ever been a teacher, though, perhaps you know that experience of turning to write some simple word on the blackboard and boom, suddenly it's gone. Okay, Revelation represents a type of literature which we call apocalyptic. And I want to introduce us to that kind of literature and to the Book of Revelation itself. Now, the Greek title for the Book of Revelation is Apocalypsis, which means the unveiling or the laying bare. And it's an expression of a kind of literature that arose sometime around 300 years before the time of Christ among the Jewish people. And it had to do with the revealing or the unveiling of what is the meaning of history. What is the meaning of what has taken place, and what will happen eventually as God comes into his world to redeem it finally and completely. And that developed into a kind of literature all in itself. And if we understand that literature, I think it's easier for us to understand the Book of Revelation. If you'll give me just a second to get... So I want to talk briefly about some characteristics of apocalyptic literature in general. And the first characteristic is that it tends to be deterministic. And it tends to describe set periods. There should be an S on period up there. Set periods of history. In other words, God has so determined the course of history that you can divide it into set periods. The thrust of apocalyptic literature is that what happens in history, especially toward the climax of history, is the movement of events that are so important that it doesn't really matter about you and me. That is, that we can't do anything about it. Now, the challenge of apocalyptic literature is to remain faithful, to be sure, to remain faithful amid what is happening, but so far as determining the course of history goes, human beings have nothing to do with that any longer. That is determined by God and the cosmic struggle that's underway. And that leads to the second characteristic. And I'll tell you when these characteristics are not applicable to Revelation. The second characteristic is that it's dualistic. It imagines the whole thing to take place in a dualism between good and evil. The mighty forces of God against the mighty forces of evil. And that a cosmic battle is underway. And that is what is determining the course of history. So everything is conceived of in that dualistic way. And so what that means for you and me is, which side of the dualism are we on? Are you out with the forces of God, or are you with the forces of evil? And it's a kind of simple understanding of that, you see. But in a sense, very profound, because it assumes that the course of history is shaped by that struggle. The third characteristic is that, as you well know this, don't you? Apocalyptic literature tends to be symbolic, to use these wild, sometimes grotesque images, symbols. And of course, what they are is what I like to call word pictures. Word pictures. And they therefore have a certain character of poetry about them. That is, they're not designed to describe literally what is going to happen or what is taking place, but rather to speak of it in poetic language and word pictures. And we'll see lots of those. Let me just, for instance, in the book of Revelation, we see a number of images, sometimes very grotesque images, of evil. And of course, what's going on there is, how can you imagine the very worst evil that's conceivable? Then how do you picture that? See, and that's what John tries to do in some of his symbols in the book of Revelation. And he gets that pattern from apocalyptic literature in general. The fourth characteristic of apocalyptic literature is not true of the book of Revelation. But for the most part, apocalyptic literature is written under the honored name of a person of another time. In other words, apocalyptic literature is pseudonymous, meaning it's written under a false name. And the idea is to relate it to some famous person of the past. For instance, there is a Jewish apocalyptic book called First Enoch. And of course, it's claims to have been written by the Enoch of the book of Genesis, you see, and sealed up until this time when it's revealed. And so it very often carries that name. Now, we today would call that plagiarism, and people would be in hot water for it. But around the first century, there was a different way of thinking about that. You honored another person by writing a book in his or her name. So that there are, for instance, in the New Testament, we think, letters not written by Paul, but carrying Paul's name. And it was a way of disciples of Paul, or followers of Paul, to honor him. Well, that's often done in the case of apocalyptic literature. In the case of Revelation, it is startling, though, that John gives us his real name, where he is and everything. And there's no effort to attribute it to some honored person of the past in order to get your attention. And that's important, as we'll see in a moment later on. Fifth, apocalyptic literature is almost always written in a time of persecution and or hopelessness. A period for apocalyptic literature in Judaism is about 300 before Christ to about 100 of the Christian era. And through that whole period, of course, the Jews are experiencing oppression and sometimes persecution, and apocalyptic literature was a response to that. I think that's easy enough. The sixth characteristic is simple too. That is that the message of apocalyptic is always mediated through a heavenly being of some sort, an angel, or in the case of Enoch, of course, he was taken up into heaven and had resided in heaven all this time before writing this book. And it's true, of course, in Revelation that John has this experience in the spirit, an angel speaking to him, etc. Finally, most often, apocalyptic literature addresses the abuse of political power and of social justice and intends a liberation from those forces. In other words, apocalyptic literature was very political in its own day, and always,
Yeah, I think always I can say, undermine the political forces of that time. And we'll find that to be true of John, undermining the Roman power and the abuse of power. And so in a sense, even though it's hard for us to relate to this sometimes, in a sense, apocalyptic literature is liberation literature. It's an attempt to liberate people from the oppression of the time. Now, those are just seven things, and it's just accidental, but it's pretty good anyway that we got seven of them, isn't it? Yeah. That'll prepare us. Any questions or reactions to any of that? Incidentally, I hope that, I'll have some input, but I hope we'll get lots of discussion, questions answered, discussion among you, so please don't hesitate to speak. Yes, sir?
Back up to item 2 on your dualistic characteristics of this apocalyptic literature, you're dealing with the cosmic conflict, and you mentioned that the unimportance or the ineffectiveness of the human beings, the people at the time.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the whole conflict is over the people, is over you and I, our souls.
Yes.
And so we have a key part in this.
Yes.
Conflict.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I appreciate your mention. We're powerless to do anything to shape the outcome of it, but yeah, the human being is caught between these two forces, and that's precisely who's going to reign the world and human beings is precisely the question in the dualistic battle. I appreciate that point. That's very important. How would we say it? We humans are the stakes, as it were, what's being fought over here. Good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Is that last point number 7 related to point number 3? Is it causally related, or is did the symbolic and poetic aspect of the literature come out of that 7th reason?
Yeah, in a sense it did. What are you thinking?
It would be difficult to get to disseminate your work if it was questioning the authorities that were in power. So I would think that they might have to write it in a way that was kind of subtle and obscure.
Yeah, very good. Yes, there is a theory that this element of apocalyptic literature was originally a kind of code, because it's subversive literature, and so you write in images and symbols which will be understood by the people you intend your message for, but not by the political personnel, the political forces at hand. In other words, Revelation may be intentionally obscure and confusing because John knows that his original readers will understand these, and it's filled with allusions to the Old Testament and to Jewish apocalyptic literature. And he knows good and well that a Roman would have the foggiest notion what was going on there. Yes, that's one theory of the origin of the symbolism of apocalyptic literature. And I'm not sure that that's always the case, but I think there's certainly some truth in it. That's an issue that's debated by the scholars of apocalyptic literature. Thank you, that's a very good point. Yes, sir?
Point one, the deterministic aspect seems to have the maybe a predestination type of thing to it, and that we're just along for the ride.
The difference is, the point that was made over here, that our destinies are not predetermined, you know, in the sense that, okay, you people are going to be saved, those people aren't going to be. Not in that sense. But rather, we are free to join one side or the other, and that will result in our destiny. So we have freedom in that way. But the course of those events, you see, isn't going to be determined by us. In other words, apocalyptic literature would say it really does no good to mount a revolution against the Romans, because we cannot overthrow the Roman power in that way. God has determined the way in which Roman power will be overthrown. So you see, it's deterministic in that way, but not predestinarian, I think. And so that makes this gentleman's point even more important. We are sort of, human beings are sort of the stakes in this struggle. Thank you, that's a good clarification. We need to move that. Other observations or questions? Yes?
Do we know, are we sure that it is the same John as the evangelist?
No, no, we're not sure. As a matter of fact, I would have to say that we don't know who this John was. There are those who think that it's the same John who wrote the Gospel of John and the letters of John. If that's true, he writes in a much, much different language and style in Revelation than he did in the Gospels. So I suppose most scholars do not think that John of Patmos, as we call him, because that's about all he tells us about himself, was not John the evangelist. There is an interesting theory around today that just has been revived, and that is that it's John the Baptist, which is, but naturally it delays the beheading of John the Baptist. I guess one could say he lost his head and then he wrote Revelation.
Unless someone wrote to honor John the Baptist.
Yes, that's possible. That's possible. That is indeed possible, yes. I don't know what to say to that, but that is indeed possible. I don't know how we can show it one way or the other. John was a common name. Obviously, he is known by those Christians in the churches to which he's writing, so he doesn't have to identify himself and say, here are my credentials, you know. He doesn't have to do that. All he can say is, John of Patmos, on the island of Patmos, because of the word of God and having experienced the tribulations that you're experiencing, and right away his readers seem to know who this is. But we don't, and we wish that he would have given us a little footnote, you know. But it was a common name. Good question, thank you.
May I be permitted a little levity to put in this?
Oh, please do! What we need is levity.
I am a Presbyterian background. You know, my theology has a certain amount of predestination in it.
Uh-huh.
This is a story about a Lutheran and a Presbyterian that were attending a meeting like this. Uh-huh. They had just left the program and were walking down the stairs and one of the planks broke, and they both tripped quite badly. And the Presbyterian, or the Lutheran, said, "Hey, I think we'll have to be more careful next time." And the Presbyterian's comment was, "Thank God, that's over."
Oh, very good. I think that's an ideal place to make a transition. I have a hunch that none of you out there really gives a hoot about how apocalyptic literature arose and why it arose. Maybe that's the last question on your mind on this Monday morning in Holden Village. But since I'm teaching the course, by golly, we're going to talk about it. No, I'm intrigued with the question of why, about 300 years before Christ, did this kind of literature begin to be written? And there are perhaps four reasons which may kind of help us understand the character of apocalyptic literature. It is apparently quite clear that apocalyptic thought arose under the influence of Persian religion. So that concepts like the resurrection of the dead, the final judgment, a personified evil like Satan, those are concepts of the Persian religion which seemed to have entered Jewish thought under the time of the Persian domination of the Hebrew nation. So that some of it is clearly taking Persian religious thought and, we would say, baptizing it, making it Jewish, making it Hebraic, so that we could use it. The second reason is perhaps the demise of prophecy until the Messiah comes. believed that sometime after the return of from exile and the resettlement in Judah, that the spirit of prophecy departed from the people. And if you notice, there aren't any prophets after about 400 or 500. And all these verses down here, which you can, if you're interested, and I, you know, perhaps you're not, but all these verses here indicate that attitude, that the spirit of prophecy has departed from us. It will come again with the Messiah. And that's why, of course, in the New Testament, it's so very important that the spirit of prophecy is alive in the Christian, among the Christians, you see, because that indicates that that the age of the Messiah has come, and God has poured out his spirit, you know, as Joel says, on all persons, and they will prophesy. The third reason is that in this period, the Hebrews, the Jews, despaired of history. If you know this period, you know that they are dominated by one nation after another, and their times of freedom are very, very limited. And there is a sense in which apocalyptic literature says this historic order is so corrupt that God can't redeem it. And so God's going to have to step in and sort of boom, in this historical order, destroy it, and start a new one. And that attitude that history is beyond redemption opened the doors for apocalyptic thought, you see. And actually, we could say that the prophets in the Old Testament always believed, to some degree, that God could redeem this historic situation. God would come, and we'd beat our swords into plowshares, and et cetera, et cetera. Apocalyptic thought tends to say, no, God has to really reconstruct, reorder history and the world. And so there's a certain despair over history, and a look at, and the hope is transferred to a time beyond history. So apocalyptic thought entered here to take the place of prophecy, and it entered Jewish thought also because of a certain despair over history. And finally, last but not least, apocalyptic thought is a response to the problem of theodicy. That's a big two-bit word. You know, since I'm the teacher, I got to use some two-bit words to convince you that, you know, I know a little bit something. Theodicy is just the problem of the justice of God. It's the problem that Job wrestled with why do the righteous suffer? Why is it that rat down the street, everything's going well for him, you know, he's got three or four cars and a new furniture and a lake cabin and all, and he hasn't set foot in a church and doesn't believe anything. How come he's prospering and we are suffering the way we do? That's the problem of the justice of God. And that problem arises in the Old Testament, and there are several parts of the Old Testament that wrestle with that, but they never solve it satisfactorily. They don't sufficiently solve it. Job is an example. Job really, you know, tells us this whole story about injustice and all, and finally says, you can't explain it. You can't explain it. By faith, you just live on and trust God. Well, apocalyptic literature solves the problem of the justice of God. It says God's justice will prevail, will be worked out at the end time. And the righteous will be rewarded, and the sinner, the wicked, will be punished. It is an answer to that problem. Now, if you're interested in that problem, let me suggest to you a very good course that's going on right now, or beginning this afternoon, taught by my wife, Myrna, on suffering and the problem of suffering, the Old Testament answers, the New Testament answers, and contemporary Christian answers. Honey, you want to stand up and visit? This is my wife, Pastor Myrna Kaiser. And she is my pastor, incidentally. I sit in her congregation and hear her preaching. And every Sunday. That's why I'm such a good Christian, is because of her preaching. No. Her preaching is good. Her preaching is not the reason I'm a bad... Oh, forget it. Okay, but that course deals with the question of theodicy, you see. And apocalyptic literature and Revelation in particular is an answer to that question. We'll lean on that point a couple of times in the future. But let me just tell you very quickly that some of the apocalyptic literature that is important to give you an idea. In the Old Testament, there are just bits and pieces of it. Those chapters in Isaiah, half of the book of Zechariah, and perhaps the most famous example is Daniel 7 through 12. And that's perhaps the clearest, best example of apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament. You know, he's got that four-headed beast that comes out of the water. That's a good apocalyptic thought. Well, then, between the end of the writing of the Old Testament and the beginning of the Christian era, in what we call the intertestamental period, we Christians call it that, there was a lot of Jewish literature that is apocalyptic. First Enoch, Second Baruch, Fourth Ezra, all of it about the time 150 before the Christian era, on into the end of the first century of the Christian era. So all of this is background for Christian apocalyptic thought, you see? And I hope that what you see is that was a movement, that was a way of thinking, that was a way of addressing the world and its problem. In the Old Testament, and late in the Old Testament, after 300, and in Jewish thought. In the New Testament, there are bits and pieces of apocalyptic literature. Perhaps the most famous is that passage in Mark chapter 13, and Matthew and Luke both have parallels to that. They have their own versions of it. Paul, in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, speaks apocalyptically a couple of times. And then it's interesting that he doesn't use that language later on, but those are apocalyptic. Jude, in a sense, you know, part of this is a question of what do you call apocalyptic and what you don't call apocalyptic. Jude is perhaps an example, but of course the primary example of Christian apocalyptic thought is Revelation. Okay, history lesson over, right? No more history. Well, I can't say that, but history lesson over for now. Any observations or questions before we turn to our last concern for this morning?
Tell us again what you mean by intertestamental.
Okay, intertestamental, it's a Christian word, obviously, to talk about the literature that is written between the time the Old Testament is over and the beginning of the Christian movement and the first writings along about 45 or 50, something like that. Now, that's not exactly true because, you see, I guess the way I've dated it, that's okay, yeah. Beginning about 200 or 150 before the time of Christ. There's a whole slew of literature there, part of which is the Apocrypha, which the Roman Catholics include in their Bibles, and we are beginning to now print it. Martin Luther kind of threw it out of the Bible, and so it's making its comeback very gradually. And then a whole slew of other literature that never was canonized in any way. And the Qumran, those of you who know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran literature is, we would call, intertestamental. Evolved in the Jewish life and faith somehow in that period in between. Good. Glad to clarify that. Other questions or observations? Our time was a little short today because of the fire alarm, but I don't want to rush anything. We shouldn't rush things at Holden Village. We're here to learn and grow in a peaceful and slow way. And if I talk like this all week, we'll never get through Revelation. Okay, now I want to dump my whole load on you, as it were, and suggest to you. Five principles of interpretation which will prevail in my approach to Revelation and principles which I recommend to you. And the first is, keep in mind the historical setting of the book of Revelation. But I haven't suggested to you what that is yet, have I? So I better do that right away. We think, most New Testament students think that Revelation was written around 95, at the end of the first century of Christian, and it was during the time of the persecution of the Christians and the Jews by Caesar Domitian. Domitian had what we might call a rather big ego, and that is that he wanted to be worshipped as God. That's a pretty big ego, I guess I'd say. He was propagating that view in the Roman Empire that the Caesar should be regarded as a divine God on earth. And hence, people were asked in what is called the emperor cult, the worship of the emperor, people are called to confess Caesar Nero as Lord, Kyrios. And it's not accidental that the Christians, of course, were propagating the point of view, Christ is Lord, Kyrios, right? And, for many in that day, that was no problem, because you could say, okay, the emperor is God, I believe that, but I go right on with my other religion. But the Jews and the Christians were put in the bind, weren't they? Because they were monotheists. And so the Jews and the Christians were singled out for persecution. And Domitian insisted that if any Christian came to the attention of a local official of some sort, that Christian should be asked to curse Christ and pledge allegiance to Domitian as Kyrios. And if not, then they might well be put to death. So it's that kind of setting, a time of persecution, a time when Christians are on the line with their lives for what they believe. And it certainly, for many, looked hopeless. It looked as if Domitian would destroy Christianity. So that's the kind of setting. Important that we keep that in mind as we read the book of Revelation. And then my second principle of interpretation is that you remember that Revelation was a message for its own day before it was a message for our day. Now, there are two extremes in interpreting Revelation. The one extreme is to say, John wrote about and only about our present, the middle of the late 20th century. And so everything there is about our day, and its message is for our day. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that it leaves the Christians of the first century without a message in the book of Revelation. It says, in effect, that John didn't try to encourage the Christians under persecution. The other extreme, then, and some scholars go to this, is to say that it was a message only for John's first readers and really has nothing to say to us. My thesis is, and it's not an unusual one, that what we must do is understand what John was saying to the Christians, the churches of his own day, and then on the basis of that message that he has for his own day, we ask, what does that message mean for us today? And this then is the first step and the necessary step to that. You see, otherwise, what you end up doing is you can make the book of Revelation mean anything you want it to mean. You can fill those images and those symbols with anything you want to. God speaks in the book of Revelation and tells us that all bearded people are of the devil, and they should all be wiped out. You see, you can almost make it mean anything. If, on the other hand, you try as best you can to determine this, then that gives some control over the meaning it has for today. Well, I'll be working on that the rest of the week. Third, appreciate the symbolic, poetic nature of the contents of the book. I don't have to say much about that. But appreciate that poetic quality that we were talking about a moment ago. And remember John tells us in the first chapter that this book is intended to be read aloud in the churches. And so it was intended to be read aloud, to be heard, rather than to be read. And sometimes it might be fun for you to sit and read out loud some of those images of the beast and the horrors and all of the other things and have someone else listening and hearing without seeing the words themselves. It might be a good experience.
What kind of rating would this get on?
Pardon?
What kind of rating would this get in a movie or on TV?
Well, yeah, I think it'd be an R at least, if not the other, yeah. Well, of course, the other thing I'm going to try to do is to show you that these images should not be taken literally, that John doesn't mean a literal description of what is taking place. Okay, and the fourth is just part of John's perspective, which we need to keep in mind because it may be a little different from our own perspective, and that is that what happens in this world and this history is, for John, a reflection of what is taking place in the heavenly realm. So when he describes this cosmic struggle, you see, in the heavens, what he's doing is saying that is the meaning of what is taking place right here in our own midst on the historical plane. That's a little different from the way we would perhaps think. So we need to keep that in mind. And finally, last but not least, I think it's very important as we read each verse that we keep in mind the general message of the book of Revelation. And this doesn't exhaust that general message, but two points I would make. One is that Christian suffering or martyrdom is the continuation of God's redemptive work begun in Christ. And that is a very important point in John. John believes that the suffering that the Christians undergo because of Domitian and because of the political power of the time is a way in which God is, through these Christians, continuing what he did in the cross. In the cross, Christ took the evil of the world, died, was raised from the dead, overcame that evil, and now Christians are doing the same thing. As a matter of fact, someone has said that for John, Christians are like sponges sopping up the evil of this world into themselves and bringing their death so that God can triumph over evil eventually. Now, don't miss it. John is not saying, quick, run out and find somebody who will cut your head off, and you'll be a great Christian. He's not that at all. He doesn't like it any more than anyone else. But he says, as it comes, we must understand our suffering, our persecution, in the light of what God did for Christ. And then, of course, the last point is that God will ultimately triumph over evil, no matter how hopeless the present may seem. Seem? Yes, seem. And, of course, that's a message that you and I need to hear over and over again, don't we? Because sometimes we're not too sure that's the case. But the book of Revelation asserts that no matter how hopeless the situation may be, God has the last word. And so it was so very appropriate, Dan's little story last night, John Nelson's reason for rejoicing, even when the arms race has accelerated in spite of all of his good efforts, and his point is he knows how the story ends. And Revelation is, in a sense, the end of the story, so that Christians can know where it's going to end, and hence have courage to face this phase of the story that we're in now. I'm rushing a little more tomorrow. There'll be more, I promise, more time for discussion, but are there any final questions or observations or corrections? Or yes, sir.
In this period of time, 95, not only is this the conflict period of Rome, but this is just after the excommunication of the Christians from the synagogue.
That's right.
That would be a terrible traumatic.
That's right, yes. Yeah, that's right. It is a terribly traumatic experience, and we'll notice in the letters to the seven churches, John has some unkindly things to say about the synagogues in a couple of these towns, probably because that very thing has happened. The Christians have been expelled from the synagogue. And incidentally, having been expelled from the synagogue also made them vulnerable to persecution in a different way, because the Romans generally would hold that in a nation that they conquered, the established religion would be honored and could go on. But new religions were not allowed to arise. Once the Christians are kicked out of the synagogue, they then are presented to the Romans as a new religion, not a continuation of Judaism, you see, and so they're no longer protected by that, and hence they're vulnerable in a more direct way to persecution than they had been. So it's a very traumatic period, right. It is for Judaism also, incidentally, but we shan't get into that for now. Thank you for making that point. Yes, sir.
Was Revelation understood any better then than it is today?
Yes, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. Part of our problem is that we do not live in that mentality any longer. And frankly, another reason that it's difficult for us is that we don't know our Old Testament as well as we should. And if we knew it, we would see a great deal more what John was getting at by calling to mind these Old Testament images. But these Christians probably also knew that other Jewish apocalyptic stuff, 4th Ezra, 2nd Baruch, and so they would doubtless be better able to understand it for that reason. But John is writing a mystery, to be sure, because what God intends to do is veiled, is not clear. And he's trying to present that mystery and unveil it for us. So even then, it was, I think, what we had to ponder. See, the other thing with Revelation is that it hits you and it makes you think about it yourself. You see, it just doesn't give you the answer, a head answer, but it hits you with one of these images. It just about bowls you over. Perhaps it's abhorrent to you. But you got to think about it. You got to wrestle with it. And John is trying to do that with it.
Do you think one of the reasons we have a problem today with this message of hope is because we struggle in this contemporary society with the concept of mystery?
That we do struggle with the concept of mystery. Why don't you say a word or two about that? I think.
I'm wondering, I think you said a good word to us about it being a message of hope. Uh-huh. But in most exegetical work that we hear today on the book of Revelation from well-known preachers, it tends to be a book of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Someone said doom and judgment, yeah. And fear.
Yeah.
Is that fact because we want to have answers rather than willing to live in that sense of mystery and God's working in history?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the popular interpretation of Revelation is intended as a way of giving some certainty, something you can know for sure. And it does, it is an effort, therefore, to take the mystery out of God's action, to take the mystery out of what we think God is doing. And John writes in the way he does, in part, simply because he affirms that mystery. Other questions? Or? Well, I have 1 minute till, so this is a good time to adjourn. Thank you for your patience today. We will see you tomorrow. We'll dive in. If you get a chance, read about the first 4 chapters or so of Revelation. We'll try to deal with those tomorrow. Have a good day.
Thank you.